Chapter 13. I quickly called together the senior military staff, plus Dr. Friedlander of the science team, to meet with me and Chotek, and of course Skippy. Chotek had already heard the bad news from Skippy before I was able to talk with him. I had anticipated an argument with the UN bureaucrat. Instead, to my relief, he agreed we needed to discuss this situation and see if there was anything we could do to assist UNEF. Everyone has heard that a Kristang battle group currently has space superiority above Paradise? Everyone around the briefing table nodded. The Kristang being back in control there poses an unacceptable risk to UNEF on Paradise, and we need to determine whether there is something we can do about the situation. Something we can do, I glanced over at Chotek, without exposing our presence. Skippy, let's start with you. I want a way for us to assist UNEF on Paradise. Ugh, Skippy groaned. Half the time when you're talking, Joe, I have to guess what you are truly trying to say through a jumble of blah, blah, blah while you ramble around the point. It would help if you were more specific, Joe. Not only would it help me, it would help your own murky thinking process if you could define exactly what you want to accomplish. What I want, I said very slowly to give me time to think, is... What did I want? I wanted Skippy to magically beam every human on Paradise back to Earth, but he couldn't do that. I knew that because I had already asked him, and he told me no. He also said he hoped I had been joking about that. I was, sort of. Mostly. So what did I want? I wanted UNEF to be safe. Safer. Relatively safe. That meant, unfortunately, making sure the Ruha kept control of Paradise. The fragile ceasefire on Paradise was the only thing keeping the Kristang from taking revenge on humans they considered traitors. If the Kristang had unchallenged control of the planet, they could slaughter and enslave humans with complete impunity. None of the rules that govern combat between the Maxolks and Rindaloo factions protected client species from being abused by their patrons. Great. All I needed to do was to somehow arrange events so that a powerful star-faring species maintained control of a planet they didn't want in order for them to protect humans who the Ruha wished would just go away. And arrange events without the Kristang, Ruha, or UNEF ever knowing we were ever there. Easy. Hey, we'd already saved Earth twice. How difficult could this be? Think, Joe. Think, I told myself. Break the problem down into manageable pieces, then solve each piece. Think of the problem as an enemy and defeat them in detail. The situation had been much more favorable to us having a chance to influence events before the Kristang battle group arrived and established space superiority around Paradise. With the battle group in firm control, the default situation was the Kristang merely needing to hang on until the Ruha eventually grew tired, negotiated a settlement, and evacuated the planet. Before the Kristang battle group surprisingly jumped into orbit, the Ruha could have kept the planet or not. It was their choice. We needed to make continued possession of Paradise the Ruha's choice again. We needed to eliminate that Kristang battle group. Here's what I want. A way to take out that Kristang battle group in a way that the Kristang and the Ruha don't know we are involved. Without that battle group, the Kristang will not be in such a strong position to negotiate to get Paradise back. Without that battle group, the Ruha can drive a hard bargain on Paradise, and maybe the Kristang won't be able to offer a sweet enough deal. Maybe the Ruha won't be tempted by the Kristang's offer and they keep the planet. Maybe there is even something we can do behind the scenes to make the Ruha decide to keep Paradise. Without that battle group, UNEF isn't in immediate danger of being wiped out. As long as that battle group is in orbit, the Kristang have the upper hand in negotiations, and the Ruha are much more likely to surrender the planet permanently. That is the simplest way to state the problem, Skippy. No magical beaming UNEF back to Earth, just a simple military problem. Find a way to deal with that battle group. Simple. Skippy's voice was incredulous. You think that is simple? Unbelievable. Over 20 Kristang warships, not to mention their support ships. Opposing them are a handful of Ruha warships and our pirate ship. We can't really count the Flying Dutchman as a combat asset because we can't openly engage in combat. Also, you need to remember that our pirate ship is pretty beat up. We would have difficulty directly engaging those Kristang cruisers or even a pair of destroyers. I didn't say it would be simple. We understand that we are facing a substantial combat force and we need to take them out of the equation. When you say deal with or take out that battle group, Skippy interrupted, you really mean destroy those ships, right? Is that what you want? It would be super helpful if you got straight to the point, Colonel Joe. Yes, I suppressed a sigh. Skippy was being extra difficult today. I want to destroy all or a substantial part of that battle group's combat power. That means destroying those ships, or at least knocking out their weapons. If we can reduce the battle group's combat power, if we can even the odds, then the Ruha may decide it is worth sending reinforcements. Right now, the Ruha fleet doesn't want to commit the number of ships that would be required to take on the Kristang. The Ruha aren't willing to commit that many ships to reestablish control of a planet they are trying to negotiate away. If we can somehow even the odds so it is tempting for the Ruha to retake the planet, then they may come back, even if it is only so they will have greater bargaining power in giving away the planet. Then we'll be right back to the problem of the Ruha selling the planet out from under UNEF, Chang reminded me. Yes, but that is not the immediate problem. We need to first deal with the Kristang having unchallenged control over the planet, bring the situation back to equilibrium. I surprised myself for using that word. Where had I learned that? If the odds are back to even between the Ruha and the Kristang, there might be something we can do to influence the negotiations for transfer and control of the planet. Right now, we don't have that option. Well then, Joe, Skippy mused. You have finally framed the actual objective, destroying the Kristang battlegroup. Now I can start thinking about how to do that. Great. Is this where you go silent and your little beer can gets warm while you crunch like a trillion variables?
Please, Joe. Way more than a trillion, he snorted derisively.
Understood. Can I assume you can't do something simple like use the Therena nanovirus to seize control of those Kristang ships?
Duh.
No, Joe, I would have mentioned that right away. Nope, I can't do that this time. Even my awesome powers are only able to activate the nanovirus on 3 ships at one time because of the distances involved in space combat. Also, the Kristang task force is wisely dispersed far around Paradise. I could only get a maximum of 4 ships within range from any particular point in space. So, using the nanovirus is impractical. The reason that trick worked when we first arrived at Earth is those 2 Kristang ships were relatively close to where we jumped in. Here, if we jumped into low orbit, I could only activate the nanovirus on 3 ships. The other 17 warships would see what happened, and we would never be able to use that trick again. The Theranin would also lose the secrecy of the nanovirus being embedded aboard Kristang ships, although I don't think any of us will be weeping for those little green pinheads. Remember, Joe, the Theranin designed the nanovirus for the purpose of taking control of Kristang ships at the time they are attached to a Theranin star carrier. It is a short-range technology. And in case you're thinking we can jump in far away from Paradise and sneak up on the Kristang in normal space, forget about it. When I rebuilt the Dutchman, I wasn't able to bring our stealth capability back to full effectiveness due to lack of the proper raw materials. Even the Kristang's crappy sensors would eventually detect this large ship sneaking around in Paradise orbit. Understood, Skippy, I said with a frown. The truth was I had been hoping he could use the nanovirus trick in some way. And again, thank you. You did a remarkable job rebuilding the ship out of moon dust. The Merry Band of Pirates does appreciate it more than we can say. All right, Mr. Chotek. At this point, I think we let Skippy consider our options, while my staff also tries to think of a strategy to destroy all or most of the Kristang battle group around Paradise. Chotek nodded agreement. These military matters are your area of expertise, Colonel Bishop. Mr. Skippy, I am sure your incredible brain power will develop a range of innovative solutions for us to consider. Working on it right now, Skippy acknowledged. Although I don't know why you can't simply use the projectors. That's why I have difficulty understanding your concepts of military strategy. You don't take advantage of the easiest... What projectors? Chang asked before I could open my mouth. The Terawatt Maser Cannon projectors buried beneath the surface of Paradise, duh, Skippy explained. Damn, you monkeys are especially dense sometimes. Like a neutron star, only not as smart, and more smelly. Chang and I shared a dumbfounded look. I was the first to speak. There are giant maser cannons on Paradise? Why haven't the Ruha used them against the Kristang? Yes, there are maser cannons.
Big ones, Skippy's voice carried a mocking tone.
Cannons capable of delivering over 10 terawatts in a single shot. Cannons like that can burn right through a starship's shields, especially if the shield is close, like in orbit. To answer your moronic question, the Ruha can't use the projectors because they don't know about them. Man, do you even listen to yourself talk sometimes? Maybe hearing your own stupidity is too painful for...
Skippy, I shouted in frustration. I did not know about any projectors. Are these projectors something UNEF built? Huh? Wow. This is truly a breakthrough. Joe, that may be the dumbest thing you ever said. We should have a cake to celebrate the occasion. A banana cake. UNEF. Constructing maser cannons. Out of what? Mud and sticks? No, UNEF was not involved. They also have no idea there are powerful planetary defense cannons beneath their feet. The Kristang installed those projectors, Joe. And what do you mean you didn't know about them? I told you all about it, like a long time. I'm sure I did. Did I? Oh, boy. His voice trailed off. I'm sure that I told somebody. Or maybe not. Anyway, you know about it now, so we're good. Yep, goodness all around. While Chang buried his head in his hands, I mimed choking something. Skippy, if you had a neck, I'd choke you. How can you forget to tell us something that important? Hey, there is a ginormous amount of data rattling around in my brain, Joe. I can't keep track of everything you monkeys don't know, he grumbled. Everything you don't know would fit inside the freaking galaxy. Chotek took a deep breath. Colonel Bishop, I am beginning to see the difficulties you have in working with our super-smart alien friend. Oh, shut up, Count Chocula, Skippy said defensively. Anywho, Joe, you know now. Details, Skippy, I said quietly. We could use some details. What you said doesn't make sense. If the Kristang installed those projectors, how are we supposed to use them? And why didn't the Kristang use them against the Ruha ships in orbit? And I would like to know, Chang asked. How could the Ruha not know about these weapons? The Ruha have occupied this planet for— Skippy groaned. Damn it, if you will stop pestering me with ignorant questions, I will attempt to smack some knowledge on you. I'm not confident that it will be successful, but I am willing to give it my best shot. We would appreciate being smacked down upon, O Great One, I said sarcastically. Assuming that was not an attempt at sarcasm, Joe, here is the story. The Kristang clan that originally settled this planet installed the projectors to protect their assets, mostly from other Kristang clans. When that original Black Tree clan lost the planet to the Ruhar, they put the projectors into a dormant mode and did not tell any other clans about the projectors in case the Black Tree clan has an opportunity to come back. They didn't want their own maser cannons being used against them. I had to shake my head to make sure I wasn't having a bad dream. These projectors have been buried beneath the surface all this time. Why didn't the Black Tree use their maser cannons to stop the Ruhar from taking paradise away from them in the first place? Again, with the stupid questions, Joe, Skippy chided me. The reason the Black Tree lost paradise was because the Kristang and Theranin were defeated in a major fleet engagement elsewhere in the sector. By the time the Ruhar task force first jumped into the skies above paradise, the fighting was over. The Black Tree clan handing over paradise was a mere formality at that point. There was no space combat near the paradise system. So, they gave up the planet meekly while keeping their aces in the hole concealed. The Black Trees originally came to Paradise in order to excavate the remains of a crashed Elder ship, and by the time the Ruhar arrived, the Black Trees were fairly certain they had already taken away all the valuable artifacts. Ha! They didn't know anything about me, stupid lizards! Serves them right! He paused. Wow. I'm not going to be interrupted with moronic questions. Amazing. So, to respond to your other inquiries, neither the current Kristang Swift Arrow clan nor the Ruhar know anything about the projectors. Neither of them even suspect. At the time that the Ruhar first arrived there, the Kristang population was less than 10,000, and the Black Tree's presence there was already in the process of winding down. The Ruhar never thought the Black Trees would go through the expense of constructing anti-ship defenses on such an unimportant planet. Why did they? Chotek asked. Because, Skippy explained without pausing for an insult, almost the first item the Black Tree found here was a functional Elder power tap. That is one of the most valuable items in the entire galaxy. As soon as they found that, they hoped they would find others, so they installed projectors to protect their investment. Of course, they never told the Swift Arrows or any other clans. The projectors are buried deeply, roughly 100 meters, and each is surrounded by a special type of stealth field. Any sensor scans by the Kristang or Ruhar would find only rock or whatever material surrounds the projectors. The projectors are also located in areas that are unsuited to agriculture. The Black Trees thought ahead far enough to consider another group may someday build farms and villages on Paradise. They didn't want someone to accidentally discover a projector by digging a foundation or a well.
For a minute, you could have heard a pin drop around the conference room while we all considered the enormity of what Skippy had revealed. Sergeant Adams, ever focused on practical issues, broke the silence. Skipster, she addressed him by the nickname only she could get away with, you said we could use the projectors. Is this something simple that you can hook up remotely from the Dutchman?
Ah, finally! An intelligent question!
Skippy sounded pleased.
You could learn from Sergeant Adams, Joe. You have grown substantially dumber since putting those Colonel's Eagles on your uniform.
No, Sarge Marge, Skippy said teasingly, using the nickname that only he could get away with. Before the Black Trees left the planet, they put the projectors into dormancy, anticipating it might be hundreds or even 1,000 years before the Black Trees might return. They disconnected each projector from its power source and from the control module, specifically so an enemy could not remotely activate a projector. Restoring projectors to function will require someone to physically re-establish connections. Once the connections are established, I can program their targeting sensors through something as simple as a Z-phone network.
We will need to go down to the surface, Adams concluded.
Chotek held up a hand. Sergeant, sending a party to the surface of Paradise, presumably to excavate these projectors, would pose a substantial risk of exposure to us. That is something I cannot authorize. He shook his head, but he didn't look us in the eyes when he said that.
Sir, I said, with a warning look at Adams, whose jaw was already clenching, I believe there is an alternative that does not pose a risk of exposure to us, or it poses a minimal, very manageable risk. We do not need to send a party to the surface. UNEF is already there. They can reactivate the projectors for us. All we need to do is determine a method for informing them about the projectors and provide instructions for bringing them back online.
Chotek frowned. I do not understand why we could not simply inform the Ruha about the projectors and let them deal with the Kristang. Surely, between the projectors and their remaining ships, the Ruha here would regain the upper hand.
Whoa! That is a terrible, terribly awful idea there, Chocula, Skippy said scoffingly. The Ruha's communications have been partially compromised by the Kristang. We can't tell the hamsters, because that poses too much risk of the Swift-era Kristang learning the secret.
I also think, sir, that we can't trust the Ruha to deliver the outcome we desire. I used big buzzwords that Chotek was used to. The Ruha might merely reactivate the projectors and use them to threaten the Kristang, to strengthen their hand in negotiations to hand the planet to the Kristang. What we need, sir, is a shooting war between the Ruha and the Kristang here. If a small UNEF group could reactivate projectors, and we use them to destroy most of the Swift Arrow's battle group, that will force the Ruha to take military action. It would change the balance of power, sir.
Then we might be right back to the situation before the Swift Arrow Task Force arrived, Colonel, Chotek responded. With the Ruha in a strong position to negotiate, but still in the process of negotiating the planet away beneath UNEF.
That is possible, sir, I explained patiently. The way I look at it, with the Swift Arrow battle group in control of the skies, we have no options. Without that battle group, we may be able to affect the outcome.
Affect it how? Chotek asked. We still have the constraint of avoiding exposure.
Avoiding exposure is paramount, I agreed. Right now, I don't know how we may be able to assist UNEF. But 5 minutes ago, we didn't know there was a way for us to destroy a Kristang battle group, I pointed out. One thing I have learned out here is almost anything is possible. We will have plenty of time to develop ideas before the situation on Paradise restabilizes, hopefully with the Ruha firmly back in control. A friendly local UN bureaucrat pursed his lips and thought. Before any action is taken, Colonel, I will need to see a detailed plan. We will have to assess the risks. To be clear, he stopped me before I could respond. We have to weigh the risk of exposure. He ticked the risks off on his fingers. The risk to our primary objective. And, Colonel, the risk that our operation may fail and the blowback to our people on Paradise makes the situation worse for them.
Understood, I said, and I actually fully agreed with him. If either the Ruha or Kristang learned that human troops were secretly traveling around Paradise reactivating maser cannons, the impact to UNEF could be severe. And once those cannons fired, I don't see how the Ruha could fail to figure out the humans had forced them into a shooting war. After that, the humans there may be in as much danger from the Ruha as from the Kristang.
Skippy, please provide a briefing packet about the projectors, capabilities, operational characteristics, the procedure for reactivating them, etc. Distribute the data to the entire crew, including the science team. We need everyone involved in the planning. Unit leaders, I address the Spec Ops team commanders, but especially Major Smythe. Read the briefing packet and put your thinking caps on. We have 9 days until we will be within jump range of the Paradise system, and we still need to stay here for a while. We can't leave this relay station until Skippy is satisfied his submind is properly installed and operating properly. And we need to complete repairs to the exterior of the station to maintain our ruse. Everyone, thank you, and... Wait. Skippy, what else have you not told us?
Ugh, since I don't know what it is that you don't know. The scope of your ignorance, I can't guess what I haven't told you. There is nothing anywhere near as important as secret maser cannons, I'm sure of that.
Good. Skippy's words had not reassured me. If you think of anything else, call me immediately.
I'd prefer to wait until you're in the bathroom, like usual, but for this I can break with tradition, Joe.
Paradise. Flight Leader Second Class Sally Chernendegren climbed into her two-seater Dobra fighter, the type of aircraft that humans had derisively named Chicken. On the home planet of the Ruhar, a Dobra was a fierce bird of prey, an animal to be feared in the air. Sally had not understood why the humans had renamed the aircraft after a tame, domesticated bird, other than the fact that humans were strange, and no Ruhar could truly understand such primitive creatures. As Sally attached her oxygen mask, she pressed a button, and the soft surface of the mask flowed around her nose and mouth, forming a secure seal, even over the Ruhar fur that covered her face. Human male pilots, she knew, had to scrape the fur off their faces every morning in order to get a good seal on an oxygen mask. Ruhar males grew hair on their faces also, but it was a soft, downy fur, rather than the bushy tangle that humans could grow. Humans were strange creatures, Sally thought, as she draped her arms over each side of the cockpit to show the ground crew that she was not yet touching any of the controls. Strange, and in many ways to be pitied. They had barely achieved a rudimentary form of spaceflight when they were forced into the war by the wormhole shift. Then they were brought out to the stars as expendable ground troops by their allies, the Kristang. Sally had been born and raised on Gitanu, the world called Paradise by the humans. Along with all Ruhar, she had resented human soldiers landing on her planet and forcing her people off the world that was their home. She had hated the humans, even after Sally's commanding officer noted that having humans handle the evacuation was far better than the task being managed by the cruel and untrustworthy Kristang. Some of the humans could say nasty things, but most of them had been professional, simply eager to do their jobs and go home as quickly as possible. The human leadership had been scrupulous about adhering to the code of conduct established between the Ruhar and Kristang for the evacuation. There had been remarkably few incidents of violence directed at Ruhar civilians by humans. Remarkable indeed, because humans believed the Ruhar had attacked their home world in order to enslave and destroy humanity. If the situation had been reversed, Sally did not know whether she would have been able to restrain herself. Since the humans had first landed, Sally had many opportunities to meet humans and even to spend extensive time with them. Human pilots had arrived on Gitanu with an average of 120 hours of flight training in Ruhar aircraft, having been given a rush course at some interim staging base. For pilots who would fly the high-performance Dobra gunships, most of them had less than 20 hours in that type. Humans had arrived in a potential combat zone with woefully inadequate flying experience, and they knew it. The human commander had quickly reached an agreement with the Ruhar leadership on Gitanu for Ruhar pilots to continue the training of human pilots. The agreement had been mutually beneficial. The humans gained valuable experience from experts, and the Ruhar pilots kept their own skills from growing rusty. Keeping their flying skills fresh had proved useful when the Ruhar fleet came back to take control of the planet again. Now that a Kristang battlegroup was in orbit, and the Kristang had landed combat aircraft and ground troops, Sally was especially grateful that her connection with the high-performance Dobra was still instinctive. One of the human pilots she had trained was still at the airbase, now on her ground crew. He was Lieutenant Derek Bonsu of the American Army. Lieutenant was roughly equivalent to the Ruhar rank of Flyer First Class, 2 steps below Sally's own rank. The fact that Derek, as she called him, was an American seemed to be important to him,
but meaningless to Sally or any other Ruhar. The Ruhar species had a half-dozen major cultural groups with slightly different languages, but their military was one cohesive unit. The idea that soldiers who fought side by side could owe allegiance to different governments was odd to the Ruhar. Indeed, it seemed similar to the clan culture of the Kristang. With the Kristang expending more time, effort, and passion fighting among themselves than fighting their mutual enemies, the Ruhar had been able to defeat them in almost every major engagement of their endless war, even though the Kristang economy and culture was almost entirely dedicated to supporting the war. Another thing the Ruhar found odd about humans was the different colors of their skin. In this regard, humans were also more similar to the Kristang, whose scales had many hues. Derek Bonsu's own skin was dark. He had once explained with pride that his ancestors came from a place called Africa, which again meant nothing to Saley. All Ruhar had the same pinkish-beige skin tone. It was their fur color that varied. Saley's own fur was white with patches of light brown, and fur color was neither a fashion choice nor a cultural marker for the Ruhar. She kept the fur on her head long. For flying or athletic activities, she tied her fur back in what humans called a short ponytail. The ground crew leader signaled that Saley could close her canopy and turn on the master power switch, which she did. Her weapons systems officer in the back seat announced that all of the ship's systems were ready for engine start, and she confirmed from her own instruments. Before signaling the crew chief that she was ready for engine start, she turned in her seat to look back along both sides of the aircraft. On the left side was Lieutenant Derek Bonsu with the external power cart. Saley liked Derek, although he had come to Gatanu as an enemy. Derek had an infectious grin and never complained, even when eating bland, nutrient mush 2 times a day. On the rare occasions when he received a care package of real human food from Lemuria, he treated every tomato or loaf of bread as if it were the most precious gift in the universe. Even when the Kristang battle group jumped in and took back control of the planet, Bonsu had not lost his good-natured grin for a moment. The planet had changed management several times already, Bonsu had said about the current Kristang mastery of the skies. Next week, the Ruhar fleet might get bored elsewhere in the sector and come to Gatanu to chase the Kristang away. Bonsu said no one knew what the future held, so why waste energy worrying about what you couldn't control? Along with the sunny disposition that made him popular even among Ruhar who did not like humans, Bonsu had other qualities. He had made a serious effort right from the start to learn the Ruhar common language. It helped his popularity that the first words he learned were common swear words, and soon he was cursing fluently in Ruhar. Saley noticed that now, whenever a wrench slipped and Bonsu bashed his knuckles, he cursed in Ruhar without thinking about it. But the ultimate reason Derek Bonsu was working at a Ruhar airbase instead of farming in Lemuria with his fellow humans was that he loved flying. When the Ruhar fleet had jumped in and firmly established control of the planet, their United Nations Expeditionary Force headquarters had quickly ordered all units to surrender, the alternative being for human forces to be pounded from orbit by masers and railguns. Most human pilots had flown to the nearest airbase and abandoned their ships immediately. Some pilots had set their aircraft down in remote areas near clusters of human ground troops. Some chicken crews had even spitefully ejected from their ships, causing complete loss of the aircraft. Lieutenant Derek Bonsu had calmly flown his Dobra back to its home base, bringing it down in front of his designated hangar. Bonsu had followed the guidebook's recommended procedure for engine shutdown, allowing the engines to run at idle for 3 minutes to cool before cutting power. He and his weapon systems officer had then refueled and secured the aircraft, placing covers over the intakes and hanging red tags from items that needed to be checked during pre-flight inspection. He had properly listed minor issues in the aircraft's official squawk log, noting that the nose landing gear door was slow to open and that the right engine surged for a few seconds when throttling above 80% power. Lastly, Bonsu had vacuumed out the cockpit and wiped down the display screens. That particular Dobra became Saley's assigned aircraft, and she appreciated the care Bonsu had taken with her aircraft. Such good care that her Dobra was the first to return to flight status when the Ruhar had reoccupied the airbase. All those characteristics were reasons why Lieutenant Derek Bonsu had been one of only 4 humans invited to remain at the airbase as liaisons with the Ruhar. None of the 4 humans were allowed to fly regularly, except for brief proficiency check flights every 2 months. Otherwise, the humans worked alongside Ruhar aircraft maintenance crews, and the humans took every minute of flight simulator time they could get, even waking up in the early hours of the morning to avoid taking precious simulator time away from the Ruhar pilots. At first, the maintenance crews had assigned the four humans only humiliating tasks, such as keeping the hangar floors clean and other menial work. Even now that the humans had earned the respect of the base personnel, a Ruhar was required to inspect and sign off every time a human touched an aircraft. Bonsu removed the external power cable, closed the access door, checked that it was secure, and held up an index finger, which was the Ruhar equivalent of a human thumbs-up sign. Saley acknowledged him with a thumbs-up, then Bonsu retreated with the power cable, retracting it into the cart. When the cart was safely out of the way, the Ruhar crew chief made a gesture of twirling an index finger in the air, the signal to start the engines. Derek Bonsu stood in his designated position behind the power cart, helmet on and hearing protection engaged, as he watched Saley run up the Dober's power, then take off smoothly. Derek had one hand on a fire extinguisher clipped to the side of the power cart, ready in case anything went wrong. Nothing would go wrong. All the pilots were skilled and diligent, and the aircraft were well maintained. The only potential problem Derek could foresee was that their supply of spare parts and consumable items was running low. The whole maintenance crew was concerned about the parts issue, and other air bases on Gitanu reported having the same problem. Under the terms of the ceasefire agreement, the Krestang Battle Group allowed the Ruhar to bring in supply ships, but the Ruhar government had been strangely stingy about shipping in anything other than medical supplies. Even before the Krestang Battle Group occupied the sky, Derek had heard rumors that the Ruhar federal government was considering negotiating away Gitanu in exchange for more valuable territory. Some Ruhar at the airbase said those negotiations were the reason they weren't getting critical spare parts. The government didn't plan on Ruhar being on Gitanu long term. Derek didn't know what to think about such rumors, and he didn't think rumors mattered much anyway. As he watched Saley's aircraft join up with three others and race toward the eastern horizon, there was a brief flicker of light above them. It was sunlight, glinting off a Krestang warship in orbit. While the Krestang battle group was in orbit, the willingness of the Ruhar federal government to negotiate did not matter. One way or the other, the Krestang were going to take back control of the planet, and Derek Bonsu was going to be in as much trouble as all the other humans. More trouble, perhaps, because he had actively helped the Ruhar military. Derek would worry about that later, when he had to. What he most cared about now was that his next proficiency check flight in a Dobra was not for another 6 weeks, and he did not know how he could stand to wait that long to get back into the sky. Seeing Saley soaring away in the Dobra that he used to fly caused a physical pang of pain in his stomach. He looked again at the sky, seeing another flicker of light from a ship in the Krestang battle group. If the lizards retained control of paradise, Derek knew he would never fly again. If he lived at all.